This is CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University. We respectfully acknowledge that we broadcast on unceded ancestral territory of the Coast Salish peoples. We stream online at cjsf.ca. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to our podcasts on SoundCloud and our website, cjsf.ca. Have a request? Text or call us at 778-782-2573.
I think everything is no good. Everybody's walking around going, this is no good, this won't do, everything is gone wrong.
Do you think that the society that you live in is one you ought to rebel against, or do you think you're rebelling against it?
Yes, definitely rebelling against it.
To ride.
Sitting in a van all day long.
That part's not fun.
That part is not the most fun.
Does it smell in the van?
It smells in the van.
Oh, I like it when it smells. Is it dirty in the van?
It's dirty in the van.
Oh, I like it when it's dirty.
I'm kind of gigging, Johnny, till I die.
They all listen to like most music, you know, and that's what we're doing is we're here to alleviate that, you know, get people dancing, help them remember what rock and roll used to be like and is now, but only in a very few cases.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Revolution Rock here on CJM 99.1 FM in the Windsor, Detroit area. I'm your host, Dave Kay, joined by Adam P., and we're also syndicating across several different stations here in Canada, including now CHMA in Sackville, New Brunswick. It airs Thursday evenings. Thanks to the station for adding us to your roster of great shows, and of course all the other stations as well, and CJM FM. We have a very special episode tonight.
That's right. We had a privilege, an amazing privilege, to talk with Dom Pyle, one of the founding members and drummer for Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet. And it was such a great interview. We learned a lot about the history of the band, coinciding with the release of their third record, really, in a way, their sophomore record, if you consider their first a compilation. That would be Sport Fishin', The Lure of the Bait. It's a long title.
And The Luck of the Hook.
And this is celebrating this year a massive anniversary. 30 years.
Originally released on June 25th, 1993. We kind of missed the anniversary by a week. But
we figured, hey, you know what? We're happening to have this episode on Canada Day. Why not feature one of the greatest Canadian bands of all time to celebrate this landmark occasion, this landmark anniversary, and also share with you this incredible interview? So throughout this entire episode, not only will we be airing that great interview that we conducted with Mr. Pyle, but we're also going to be playing the entire record of Sport Fishin' for you.
That's right. And you know what? It's got 24 tracks. Now, they're instrumental tracks. Some do have vocals and intros with words. But we'll talk a little bit about it as we go through the album. And also, we're going to be breaking up the interview with Don Pyle in between sets of music here of the album.
And there's just so much context to give as well about the recording of this. A lot of that is covered, though, in the course of the interview. Another huge shout-out and thank you to Don for agreeing to speak with us on this anniversary of Sport Fishing by Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet. This group, of course, I think in the popular consciousness definitely became a thing around Kids in the Hall, because with the release of that show and with the band's music being used for incidental scene breaks and also as the theme song, a lot of people just got familiar with the group. But this album was all new material recorded with the great Steve Albini, featuring a transition of their sound to something a little bit rawer, something a little bit more oriented in punk and garage, and there's even elements of some underground music on here as well.
Yeah, and there's also different styles. They branched out. Don talks a little bit about this. And then after, I believe, some more singles, the band kind of split. And then they would reform later on, many years later, with Dallas Good replacing Reed Diamond, who passed in 2001. And they played for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they actually did record music with Dallas Good for the most recent season of Kids in the Hall, and and then of course, unfortunately, Dallas Good passed last year, and the status of the band is kind of in flux right now.
So we're not quite sure what will be happening for the future of this group and any music coming out of the Shadowy Men camp, but for now we're celebrating the legacy of this album and the band by playing the entirety of the record and of course that interview with Don Pyle. We do want to encourage you to check out our website, revrock.blogspot.com. You can get more information on the show there. And I imagine we're going to be posting the interview on the website as well, coming up.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
Of course, we will be posting that.
You little sneaky Canuck. You just gave me a little Canuck surprise. I believe that's what they call it.
I don't want to know what that is.
It involves lots of maple syrup. But in the interim, I think before we get to anything with the interview itself, we should probably play the first chunk of songs coming off this record.
Yes. So when it's separated into two sides, the album starts off with two very short segments called Unwatchable. We're going to start off with the first incarnation of that. And then a couple tracks, Spend a Night, Not a Fortune, Three Piece Suit, Fortune Telling Chicken, and so on. And we'll be back. We're going to split it up with interviews that we did with Don. And so stay tuned. A very special episode here, Revolution Rock, on CJM 99.1 FM.
fortune telling chicken, it's a fortune telling chicken. Fortune telling chicken, it's a fortune telling chicken.
You are going to relax, so begin by making yourself perfectly comfortable. Sit down in your favorite chair, and you find your mind relaxing deeper and deeper. And as my voice is counting now, you will relax.
on this album, Sport Fishing, people say it's your most varied. And then also, it has a different sound than the other albums. It has a different production sound, anyway. And I know that had a lot to do with the producer of the record. But do you feel that's like an accurate description of the album? It had more varied sounds than maybe Dim the Lights or the earlier recordings? Or no?
Yeah, you know, there's a bunch of reasons for that. Like, you know, we were together for 10 years and made 3 albums, and it would take us a long time to accumulate songs for a full album, because, like, that album and the one before it had, like, you know, 20-something songs on it. I forget how many, but a lot of songs. So, you know, it would take us a while to write, like, you know, 24 songs, especially when we were doing other things, like, you know, scoring, you know, movies and TV shows and stuff. So the first album is a compilation of singles and was written as singles. Each of those songs that were on there, we wrote them kind of like thinking of them as being 7-inch singles. So I think that they have lots of like hooks, and they're kind of like maybe like the catchiest of our bunches of songs. And they also have kind of like a more mid-range tempo, partly because of ability. I think that a lot of that was ability. The second album was basically everything else that we had on our set list that didn't sound like singles. So it's kind of all over the place. I think as kind of like our sound in general was sort of a bit all over the place, but we were doing it in batches, like, you know, small batches at a time. So the sound is like slightly inconsistent, but, you know, I think the approach is kind of, you know, you can tell that we're better at playing and kind of have a better handle on how to make things sound good in the studio. But we were also using cheap studios, so, you know, some of the sounds are kind of you know, not the most hi-fi sounds. But the third album, for Sport Fishing, it was the only one of our albums that we went into a studio and recorded an album from beginning to end in one studio, in one sort of like group of sessions. So that one was different in that way. We were in, you know, a big kind of expensive studio, Chicago Recording Company in Chicago. And we had just finished a 6-week tour, so we were like really kind of at our best in terms of tightness and playing abilities. So it was a great time to do it. And you know, we were just always kind of pushing ourselves sort of further, and kind of the arrangements and on that album, I think, have a lot of that going on.
What was it like working with Steve Albini on this record? Did you all get along? Was it oil and water? What was the situation like?
No, it was great. We had been in the studio with him a couple of times before. He had a home studio in his house, and we'd gone there to record just like a few like tracks for singles or something for a compilation. And it wasn't really a test. It was more because that was what his studio was, and that was where we went, and it was just like short things. That was pretty common for us at that time to do like short sessions, because we were quite often working on singles or just like projects that required, you know, a sort of small grouping of songs. But we got along great with him. I remember when one of the times that we recorded in his house was U.S. Thanksgiving. We arrived to find out not only that Steve is a gourmet cook, but had made us a fabulous Thanksgiving spread with, like, you know, turkey and the whole shebang. So, you know, we got along really well with him. We hit it off from the beginning, and we were kind of fans of each other. You know, we had heard from an interview that he had done that he liked us, and we were fans of a lot of his stuff. Like, it was kind of before, I don't think he'd done like too many like big records. I don't think he'd done the Nirvana album hadn't happened yet, and yeah, I don't know if he'd done Pixies or whatever. But, you know, so we mostly know him from like Big Black and kind of as a person, because we met him socially from at a wedding we played out in Chicago, and there's sort of a Windsor connection, because the guy who was his roommate and who introduced us to him was from Windsor and had bought some of our singles when we were playing in Windsor one time.
Oh, wow. do you remember that guy's name? We might know him.
Yeah, Dave Viacelli is also known as Botch, who runs one of the biggest booking agents in the States.
Oh, yes.
Now. The Billy Woods Corporation.
Yes, that's okay. I think we touched on that briefly last time.
Yeah. So Botch was our booking agent. And then there were other people in Chicago, John Moore from the group Tar and Beck Dudley from the group Moto that we became friends with. So we went down to play at John and Beck's wedding. And there we met Steve and re-met Botch, who was now a booking agent, and many other people who would kind of make Chicago like, you know, one of our favorite places to play, and kind of like one of the first sort of cities in the U.S. That where we really had an audience. So, no, Steve was great to work with. The third time that we recorded with him, which was the Sport Fishing album, I remember being kind of different, not only because of, like, the studio, but because Steve had just bought a car and was shopping for car stereos. So the entire time that we were recording, he was reading magazines about car stereos. And so, you know, we'd finish a take and ask him, like, how did that sound? And he would reply, well, I don't know. I haven't heard it yet because I still have to get this stereo installed in my car. And I don't know what that stereo sounds like. So he was, like, barely paying attention, which is kind of, like, his way sometimes. Sometimes he's fully present. I guess that's one of the things about Steve is that, you know, I've seen it time and time again when you read interviews with him or hear him speak, is that it's very much a job. He's very much, like, a worker. And sometimes he's paying attention to the art. Sometimes he's not. Sometimes he's just there as a sort of technician. And he was kind of both because, you know, we were definitely friends with him and going out for meals and that with him. And, you know, he would come to see us play live. And so, yeah, we had a very good relationship and it was really enjoyable working with him.
Now, I don't know if this is true. I've read this. It said that he recorded the album for free, or is that...
No, he didn't record it for free. But in our awareness of Steve, like even knowing who we are, was from an interview that he did in a magazine, I think it was Your Flesh magazine, in which he said that when they asked him about, like, you know, how he, what he charges bands, you know, like, because he's pretty famous for not taking like a percentage, like many engineers, producers do, you know, they'll want like points on your record. He does it that, you know, you get paid for the work and that's it. That's the end. And, you know, to this day, I still prefer that arrangement. If someone wants a percentage, I'm like, forget that, because it's like inevitably going to be like nothing. I'd rather just give you the $200 up front that you're going to get from royalties than deal with half the accounting. So many people I know, so many bands I know get into conflicts with people they've done work with like that years and years later because they have an obligation to provide accounting, and it's like, I hate doing taxes. I don't even want to do that. And that's like such a burden once a year. So like doing all that, like, you know, accounting, especially when you're not getting paid from your record company, as it happened with Cargo Records, who did that album. So, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we sold this many records, but a record company hasn't paid us. So, you know, therefore we would have been paying him. But we paid him what his going rate was. But in this magazine interview, they asked him what his rates were, and he said, I would charge Depeche Mode $1 million, but I would do Shadowy Men for free.
What a